great to see you guys. Thanks for being here. Let me just pray again as we go to our passage this morning. And God, thank you for this moment. God, I thank you that we get just this wonderful gift to join together. God, let us not take that for granted. Thank you for being here in our midst. Give us eyes to see and ears to hear. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so question starting off. I know I usually end with questions, and I'll do that again. But we're going to start with a question. Your house is on fire. Everybody, you get everybody out. You have a chance to run back in and grab like one last thing. What do you grab? I'm sure those were all very meaningful answers. It was kind of a mumble. But it's an interesting question, isn't it? My hunch is that you're going back for something that's irreplaceable, right? I mean, maybe you're not. Maybe you're going straight for the cash hoard that you've got under your mattress, which I get it. But in a moment like that, right, that thing that that you cannot replace, that thing has a different sort of weight or value to it. It's not just worth something. It's treasured, right? And all of us, I think, if we think about our lives, have probably a sort of ordering of things that we treasure. But our treasures are not just possessions. They're things that are filled with deep meaning, deep value. I brought in a couple props today, but it's me that's making that noise. I apologize. But this is a bottle of bourbon. Now, it's a bottle of Pappy Van Winkle's bourbon. Anybody know the story behind this company? I mean, super rare, hard to get. They had a fire, you know, so that affected a lot of things. And it takes 20 years for this one, 23 for like the really good one. And I got this bottle for $100. I bought it on eBay. And today, if you go to High Times, it's worth $4,500. Or at least that's what they're selling it for, right? And every once in a while, somebody sees this and goes, oh, man, like, what do you do? Like, do you just take a little sip on, you know, like, special occasions? And I go, oh, no, it's empty. And the truth is, we drank it in one night. It was my 40th birthday party 11 years ago, and a couple of you were there. Horse was there. Chuck was there. It's a moment that I think back and I go, was filled with meaning for me to be there in this intimate setting, this beautiful setting with dear friends, reflective of so many things throughout my life. And the truth is this, you know, you probably sell this on eBay for $20 or something like that. It's still got a little bit of value. But the meaning to me, what it represents, is something much more that I treasure deeply in my heart. And the things that sort of matter most in life, I'm reminded of by this. And while it may be nice to have a full bottle here that I can, you know, think about maybe drinking one day or something like that, the experience, right? It's the experiences that we treasure and the texture of those experiences, the deep joy that comes in these moments of life. And learning to see our life through this sort of lens, to me, is one of the things that Jesus is there to do. I think so often we think of the gospel as like some good news for someday, when in fact I think Jesus was teaching us how to live right now. And the phrase that he uses, which is just so beautifully put, is to live life, to have life, and to have it abundantly. And I think that Jesus so often looked with a sense of heartbreak at the lack of life that he saw around him. And I wonder if today, as we look at our own lives, if we might be gently reminded that too often the way that we live is actually quenching the life, quenching the gospel, that we're choosing other things instead of the deep joy that is offered us. And part of it is simply that we just don't see it around us. Anytime I travel, I try to travel in the philosophy of Anthony Bourdain. Do you know this? He was this guy who just taught this kind of radical diving in wherever you went. Like, here's a classic Anthony Bourdain quote. He says, "Do we really want to travel in hermetically sealed Pope mobiles through the rural provinces of France, Mexico, and the Far East, eating only in Hard Rock cafes and McDonald's? Or do we want to eat without fear, tearing into the local stew, the humble taqueria's mystery meat, the sincerely offered gift of a lightly grilled fish head?" And he has this sort of vibrancy, if you've listened to him at all, and this way of approaching life that to me I find deeply romantic, and yet too often I find myself going to that same item on the menu, choosing what is familiar. I know this. I know what I'm going to get. This tendency in myself to dream big, but in the end to live small, to choose things that are comfortable and uneventful as a way of avoiding hardship, avoiding risk, to live this life that is much more resigned. I think about that statement from Thoreau where he said, "Most men live lives of quiet desperation." And see, I think sometimes in trying to hold on to life and trying to hold on to what is of value, we almost quench that thing because it requires a way of living that feels risky, but is actually filled with deep courage. And Jesus wanted us to see it, and like it would point to the kingdom being all around or it's drawn near, that this world itself could be like a thin place where heaven and earth come close. And if we're not careful, we end up wasting this life, seeking after the wrong things and missing the deep joy. I think about that statement from Joseph Campbell that you've probably all heard, to follow your bliss, right? But the truth is, Jesus said something very similar to that, tied to this idea of joy, and not just joy as like some sort of version of happiness, but a sense of like meaning, value, depth, all coming together, a way of almost peering beyond the curtain and seeing the things that really matter. Not just the things that are here today and gone tomorrow, but the things that will remain even into eternity. And we've been talking about parables these last few Sundays as ways of disrupting us from our sort of bias and comfortability, helping us see this through this like kingdom lens. And the parables are disruptors for our own heart where we're stuck to get us moving and back into the flow of the kingdom. So in Matthew 13, Jesus is going to teach once again a couple parables back to back, these small little glimpses or windows, and these are going to be familiar. But hopefully today, as we kind of digest these together, we find ourselves getting a fresh glimpse. And in Matthew 13:44, Jesus says, "The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and covered up. Then in his joy, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field." What is the kingdom like? It's like a hidden treasure. And I love this idea. It's there. It's there for those who see it. And I've taught on this passage before, and you know that, the last time I talked about this, I talked about this TV show, The Detectorists, on the BBC. Anybody seen this? Right, it's quirky and weird, but the Detectorists is about this metal detecting club over in England, and they're just the most oddball guys, right? Andy and Lance are these two like goofy friends that are out there in these fields, like looking for treasure, finding like matchbox cars and like bottle tops, but they've got this deep hunger that someday they're going to find Roman gold. And so they spend all their time walking through this, and this is the point of the show, this beautiful landscape all around, looking for this treasure, when really here they are in the midst of a world that is glorious and beautiful. But this idea of treasure seeking, right? There's something youthful about that. There's something even seemingly naive, and yet something that I think that Jesus is going, no, hold on to that. right? There's treasure there, but you got to go find it. And I guess what I'm getting at is that I think that God is the one who hides it. He hides it because he wants us to seek after it. And for whatever reason, there's part of the mystery in that as well. That he wants us to go looking and to search after it. He says, those who seek after me will find me if they search with their whole heart. It's there for us. But it requires a shift in pace, a slowing down, a pausing to go digging around. Where's the kingdom hidden? In Matthew 11:25, Jesus prays this. He says, I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you've hidden these things from the wise and learned and revealed them to babies. And this is the same word, hidden. It appears every once in a while through Scripture, but selectively. But isn't it interesting? It's hidden from like the intelligentsia and the elite. And that's not a slam on intelligence, right? But to go that sort of posture of having it all figured out. And instead, the kingdom is there for this curiosity. I always think of my little girl, Lila, was just the queen of hide and seek. And I have this Facebook memory that pops up of her where she's sitting on this chair and she's hiding from me. And she's got this massive pillow that covers her whole tiny little body, except her little feet are sticking out at the bottom. And in the picture, what's so brilliant about it is her toes are curled, you know? But you just see her like, he'll never find me, right? And the joy of this. And we tend to lose that as we go through life. But I think the fact is we don't have to. Speaking of intelligent people, Einstein's attributed to saying there's two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. And the other is as though everything is a miracle. Nan Luke sent me a link of this. You guys familiar, like all the nerds out there. Tuesday, we get photos from the web. Telescope? Anybody else? Yeah. All right, a couple of you. This is like going to take the Hubble and like, right? Hubble's old news on Tuesday. We're going to get images of the universe that we've never seen before and are like in anticipation of and listening to the astronomers that have gotten the first glimpses, and they're all like, oh, right? There's this awe and this reverence around this. And that, to me, I think, that sort of hunger to see further, to know more, this is what Jesus is saying. He's like, yes, cultivate that in your hearts. That's good soil. That we need to crave more than just information. We're looking for beauty and meaning, the things of deep value. These are the treasures. And this guy, when he spots it in a field, he kind of sneakily goes and like purchases the field, right? It's like people have debated, is this ethical, right? Like he just goes and pays less for the field than he knows it's worth so that he can get it and then go find that treasure. But the truth is, I think what Jesus is getting at is this wild act of like, whatever you have to do, go get it. If it costs everything, it's worth it. That the things of this world like are going to fade, they're going to disappear. That this treasure is worth spending everything on. And we could see that simply through a monetary lens. But my hunch is the real treasure costs us more than our money, costs us more than our time. It costs us like our ego, this selfishness, self-protectiveness, self-obsession that is constantly getting in the way of the kingdom. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he says this in his, he's got this wonderful book called The Cost of Discipleship, which, you know, he talks about cheap grace versus costly grace, and it's highly convicting, but he says this, earthly goods are given to be used, not to be collected. In the wilderness, God gave Israel the manna every day, and they had no need to worry about food and drink. Indeed, if they kept any of the manna over until the next day, it went bad. In the same way, the disciple must receive his portion from God every day. If he stores it up as permanent possession, he spoils not only the gift, but himself as well. for he sets his heart on accumulated wealth and makes it a barrier between himself and God. Where our treasure is, there is our trust, our security, our consolation, and our God. Hoarding is idolatry. And the truth is, most of us have so much stuff we don't know what to do with. Multiple storage units, right? The storage industry is billions of dollars in our country of stuff that we don't even look at, right? We've just stuck it away because we might need it someday. And the truth is, after we're gone, somebody's going to have to get rid of all that stuff, right? We hold on to so much stuff as if we possess it when, in fact, not only does it possess us, but it has this way of squeezing out our capacity to experience life. That the anxieties and the worries and the control and all of these things that we do to protect our ego have this way of diminishing our joy, our life, the abundance. And if you notice in this parable, it's joy that makes him go and spend everything. He's found this thing and he's given himself completely to it. And this is the thing. Jesus isn't saying the kingdom is the treasure. He's saying it's this whole picture here. To enter into the kingdom is to give up everything we own for the thing of ultimate value. And we do it with joy. This is the sort of window we get into the kingdom. And sometimes we kind of work this sort of negotiation strategy, like how do I maximize joy and pleasure? How do I hold on to these two things at once? And I don't know if we get to really do that. Jesus, in fact, says that eventually one of these paths wins out. You cannot serve both. And think about that for a second, because this is, I've been very mindful of this in the last few weeks as we've been going through this, how much of my time and energy goes to things like worry, goes to things like presuming upon future possibilities or worrying through different situations, making sure I've got a contingency strategy in the back of my mind or whatever it is, how much of our life goes to this sort of self-protection when in fact the joy comes from this letting go. Another Anthony Bourdain quote, he says, I'm a big believer in winging it. I'm a big believer that you're never going to find the perfect city travel experience or the perfect meal without a constant willingness to experience a bad one. Letting the happy accident happen is what a lot of vacation itineraries miss. And I'm always trying to push people to allow those things to happen rather than to stick to some rigid itinerary. And it's, he's getting at something here, right? It's this way of living that actually holds onto things very loosely. That in that space, it allows us to notice and to see. Another little treasure that I brought is, this is my Camino passport. And I was so sad, it, like downpoured, and it got soaked with rain. And I was like, oh, it's ruined. And now I'm like, oh, I love that it's all like taped together. And I'm like, it's super special to me. It represents this experience of what we went through. And my favorite stamp of all is this one that's like off, it's like stamped onto these other ones because it's raining and we step into this little tiny chapel off to the side that's like 1,000 years old, and there's this little priest in there, and he's blind, of course, right? You're like, what is going on here? And you come in, and he blesses us, and then he goes to stamp my passport, and he misses it, right? He's like, help me out here, I'm blind, like, dunk. And you look at that, and you're like, oh, like this little burning bush moment, right? Where you go, oh, God is here. This feels again like a thin place. And the gift of these is not their material value. It's how it takes you back to that reminder that God is here, God is near, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Any cost to our comfortability or control or ego is worth it. In fact, all that's an illusion anyways. All of us live in this place of vulnerability and dependence for every breath. And the chasing after that kind of thing, it gives a false sense of control. But in the end, what's going on under the surface reveals so much. So much of our deep insecurity and fear and anxiety. And once again, these are the things that quench the life and the joy. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourself treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." The joy of the kingdom is one that we experience today as well as one that goes with us after death. And these are the things that endure. And why? Because it's about your heart, which is the only thing that goes with you afterward. I've used this before, but I like, C.S. Lewis says, you don't get to take one souvenir of hell with you. It all stays behind. But your heart is what goes, and that is your gift to God, and that's God's gift to you. Our second parable, same Matthew 13, but the next two verses, 45 and 46. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls, who on finding one pearl of great value went and sold all that he had and bought it. You see the similarity here. All that you have. What is Jesus saying? You want the kingdom? You got to go all in. Everything you have. But this time, rather than it being a little treasure seeker, it's somebody who is a merchant, probably somebody who deals with pearls. Somebody who's learned to spot the real value, to see the deep beauty. And I think that for all of us, this is something that we are challenged by Jesus here to cultivate, is an appreciation for the things that really matter. When I was hired here as a youth pastor forever ago, it was by Brad Coleman, who was an artist and an art teacher, and he used to take me with him when we'd go walk through museums, and he would actually walk through really fast. And I would walk with him, then he'd pause in front of this painting and go, "Is that a good portrait or a bad portrait?" And I'd be like, "What do I know, man? Like, you're the art critic here. You're the artist. You tell me." But he would go, no, "Jeff, what do you think?" And I'd go, "Yeah, I like that." And he's like, "Yeah, it's a good painting. Why do you like that?" And I go, "I don't know." And he goes, "Let me tell you why." And he would start like pointing out things about it. And you're like, "Oh my gosh, the layers of complexity, the things he was able to see that I wasn't able to see." And I loved that because I would notice certain things or certain dimensions, and then I would notice those things in other places. And see, I think that we do this, we study Jesus because not only is he brilliant in his wisdom and in his teaching, but I think that Jesus models for us so often how to live a beautiful life. One of my favorite little glimpses into this is in Matthew 26, and it's a story I'm sure that many of you know. It says, "Now when Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, a woman came up to him with an alabaster flask of very expensive ointment, and she poured it on his head as he reclined at a table. And when the disciples saw it, they were indignant, saying, 'Why this waste? For this could have been sold for a large sum and given to the poor.' But Jesus, aware of this, said to them, 'Why do you trouble the woman? For she has done a beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me. In pouring this ointment out on my body, she's done it to prepare me for burial. Truly, I say to you, wherever this gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her.'" Jesus goes, "That was beauty." And these guys are thinking, "Oh man, the value of that perfume, what we could have done with that." And we're told in John that it was Judas who actually said that, right? And he was thinking, "Because then I could steal a little bit, like, and use it for my own gain," right? He's thinking that's what life is all about, is some sort of pleasure or to hold on to this money. He sells Jesus for this tiny little sum. You see the desperation and brokenness in his heart. And Jesus is saying, no, the beauty is in this living abundance, lavish, generous. That this woman comes in and worships Jesus with everything that she has. And he says, that will never be forgotten. She's done a beautiful thing. Do you ever wonder this? What does Jesus find beautiful? That should be a question that we're asking. And he does it in surprising ways. The widow with the mites throwing her, you know, quarter into the offering, and he's like, that's a big deal. In my kingdom, right, the metric, so much different than yours. And I love how his group of 12 disciples, his like brightest students, just never figure it out. They're always like a step behind, right? Which shows you even there the sort of patience of Jesus with us. That he keeps presenting and presenting and presenting these moments, these glimpses, saying, those who have eyes to see and ears to hear, let them hear. What Jesus finds beautiful is generous and sacrificial acts of love and vulnerability and even brokenness. Remember our early parable with the Pharisee and the tax collector, and this wretched guy over here is begging for mercy. And this guy here is so proud of the fact that he's not like this other guy. And Jesus goes, that's beautiful. Like a broken and contrite heart. A heart that looks at the truth and sees it and weighs it in all its vulnerability. And we can learn to see this way too. And he's challenging us too. To notice the things that really matter. It's been said that Van Gogh only sold one painting in his whole life. And I was reading recently about a painting that sold, I think, in 1997 for what was astounding to them at the time, three times what they thought they were going to make for this painting. It sold for $71.5 million. This self-portrait. And you go, okay, of all these paintings, or like, why this self-portrait, right? But the truth is, this moment is like such a raw and vulnerable moment. And here, Van Gogh paints this from an asylum where he's been institutionalized, having mutilated the side of his head. And here he is in this bandaged state. You see his eyes just sort of lost. He painted this for his mom. But you see somebody looking at that and going, oh my gosh, that's beautiful. This like raw honesty of this man's eyes and heart and humility. He paints it with the wound forward, right? So it's, I mean, you go like, oh, your other profile would have been much more pleasant, right? But much less beautiful. That I think there's something in this that reminds us of like, no, we get this on a deep level. We understand this. Too often we're running from brokenness instead of realizing that it's that brokenness that Jesus redeems in such a way that it's more beautiful in the end. And see, the ones searching after the treasure, I think we should understand that as ourselves, that we are to go searching after these things. But the reality is as well that this metaphor works for the heart of God on display. A heart that looks at you and sees treasure. A heart that looks at you and says, you're worth everything that I have. And Hebrews 12:2 says, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of faith, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. And Jesus, you know, like, I love that moment before all this goes down where he's in the garden going, there's got to be a less costly way. And yet not my will, but your will be done. And Jesus endures all of that for what? The joy, the reconciliation, the redemption, the transformation. That Jesus looks into all our brokenness and vulnerability and sees deep value. Three times the value that anyone would have guessed. Henry Nouwen says, our brokenness has no other beauty but the beauty that comes from the compassion that surrounds it. And I love that. We look at each other and we just see a bunch of broken people. Jesus looks at us and he sees that pearl of great price. And that value that is given is in the eyes of God looking at you with incredible love. That what he sees is you drawn into himself and himself in you, that's where the heart of joy is. That's the thing that all the pleasures in this world can never quite possess. And Jesus is saying it's actually all around you, you guys. You have to learn to see it. Learn to see the goodness and joy. I had a joyful time surfing with a couple of my friends yesterday morning, and the waves were terrible. But we were out there together, and I was riding Chuck's board, and I was having so much fun. And you're like, it's these little moments where something's happening, and you feel like Jesus is going like, oh, when you guys do that, I'm right in your midst. It happens in times of sadness. I have a cousin who's on the verge of passing away, and I've been able to walk with him through these last couple years of this. And that connection, I just go, oh, you feel God's presence right there towards the very end. It's deeply sad and deeply beautiful. It happens in little quiet moments, little like smells of a good cup of coffee, and you're like, oh, thanks be to God, right? These little liturgical moments of life. And see, I think Jesus is saying, I'm talking about a whole new way of seeing your life, that you look through this lens of deep gratitude and you don't miss it. And this is what I find, as that worry goes, as that fear gets replaced by something else, I feel so much more free. I feel free to just sit and savor the goodness. And when it says the gospel is here to set us free, I think that's so much of it. Free from ourselves, free from the baggage of our pride and our self-obsession, free from all that, so that all of a sudden now we have the space where we turn around and see the gift is in the self-denial and the joy of giving to others generously. This is how we bring the kingdom to earth. But in order to do it, we have to see it first. And God has this way of coming and bringing these little hints that lead us along the way. I've used this quote before, but I sure love it. Macrina Verdiker, I think is how you say her last name, Verdiker, who talks about it like breadcrumbs. She says, you live in a world of theophanies, which a theophany is just a visible manifestation of God. Holiness comes wrapped in the ordinary. There are burning bushes all around you. Every tree is full of angels. Hidden beauty is waiting in every crumb. Life wants to lead you from crumbs to angels, but this can happen only if you're willing to unwrap the ordinary by staying with it long enough to harvest its treasures. And I think for us, as we're going through this, I just want our eyes to become more and more open to this. Because when I see these little clues around me, I cannot help but feel like so known by God. These ways that he goes, Jeff, I just get you. And I love you. I delight in you. These quirky little things that like get all excited about telescopes in the space, right? Whatever these things are, these, you just sense this delight in God where he goes, oh, you're my child. I value you. I want my eyes to stay young and to continue to see, to notice these things, and then to spend my life giving every bit of what I've got to help others get a glimpse into that kingdom. Some questions. Number one, what are the desires in my life that are competing with the treasures of God's kingdom? Like Bonhoeffer told us, these are idols. How am I mistaking a worldly metric for a kingdom metric? How do I measure beauty through that lens of God's kingdom? Number two, what are the distractions that keep me from discovering the true treasures? How are my own fake pearls preventing me from seeking after the heavenly treasure? All these things that we collect, and God's going, oh, that's not the thing. That's not the thing. You can let that go. I have a friend who says, get rid of everything in your house that doesn't have some sort of story or meaning to it, right? All the stuff that clutters the space. And number three, are you noticing any breadcrumbs in your life? And where might God be leading you? Is there anything keeping you from following after them? I think he would tell you, it's worth it. Come find me. Those who find me will certainly find me if they seek with their whole heart. I know we're late, but I thought as a closing, I would just read a poem called The Bright Field by R.S. Thomas that you've heard me read before. But to me, captures this. And I want to say it as a prayer over us today. He writes this. He says, I've seen the sun break through to illuminate a small field for a while and gone my way and forgotten it. But that was the pearl of great price, the one field that had treasure in it. I realize now that I must give all that I have to possess it. Life is not hurrying on to a receding future, nor hankering after an imagined past. It's a turning aside like Moses to the miracle of the lit bush, to a brightness that seemed as transitory as your youth once, but is the eternity that awaits you. Would you stand with me? This week, may you have eyes to see the burning bush. Pray that God will bless you and keep you, that he'll make his face shine on you and be gracious to you, and that he'll lift up his countenance on you and give you peace. God bless you all. Thanks for being here.